Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. On May 26, 1864, the Civil War raged in the battle for Atlanta. And on that day, Abraham Lincoln signed a proclamation establishing the new territory of Montana. 150 years ago, a mere 275-year lifetimes end to end. Then Montana was fully wild country, with millions of bison across the virgin plains, and multiple nations of native peoples living on and with the land. Two lifetimes later, we are here, with automobiles, railroads, freeways, farms, ranches, cities and towns, solar windmills, cell phones, and web-based industries, and yes, wildlife and native peoples. That is our story. What were the steps along that stunning path, and what kind of people took them? We're at the Montana Historical Society to explore that question with Senior Historical Society staff members Jennifer Bottomley O'Looney and Kirby Lambert. Many thanks to both for joining us on Home Ground. We're standing in the McKay Gallery in front of a large canvas depicting bison, and the title of the canvas is When the Land Belonged to God. Kirby, would you mind telling us about this painting?
This is one of Charles M. Russell's masterpieces. There are two paintings generally considered to be Russell's masterpieces, and Montana's very lucky. We own both. One is this. One is the mural of Lewis and Clark in the state capitol. But we are looking at When the Land Belonged to God. It is a majestic, wonderful depiction of a herd of buffalo crossing the Missouri River at daybreak. The animals in the foreground, there's a lead bull surrounded by cows and calves. He's paused momentarily. The sun is coming up. He's dramatically lit from the left side of the painting. We can see steam rising off their backs. They've just come out of the water. It's early morning. And in the distant background, we see the Missouri River. And then as far as the eye can see, there are just more and more and more buffalo streaming into view.
As I look at this painting, I see power, the power of the dominant bull buffalo in the center looking straight and authoritatively at the painter, the power of the light, the rising sun, the power of the landscape, prehuman power. Is that your reaction, or how do you react to it personally, Kirby?
Well, personally, what I most appreciate about this painting is because I do know, you know, I'm familiar with Russell and his beliefs. You know, at face value, it's just a marvelous, marvelous painting of wildlife, a scene that would have been at one time common in Montana and certainly is no longer. But what's more important to me is the fact that if you look at the title, When the Land Belonged to God, it's such an incredible statement about how Russell felt about Montana, what he thought was important about Montana, the natural Montana that he loved, the early Montana that was so important to him and that he tried to capture. And I think the fact that he used the title When the Land Belonged to God says so much. I mean, he could have called it Buffalo Crossing the River. That would have been accurate, but it would not have told us nearly as much about how he felt about Montana and modern intrusions into our state.
We've now gone into one of the many galleries full of historic artifacts. We're standing in front of something, the label for which says doll-sized crow cradleboard. Jennifer, what are we looking at?
We're looking at a reproduction of a circa an 1805 style cradleboard, crow design. It's made of mineral paint with deer hooves dangles decorating the cradleboard along the side with geometric patterns, and it's a beautiful, beautifully designed, simple. It represents it's the style of cradleboard that would have been used in 1805.
Let me tell you what I see and get your response. I don't think of traditional peoples carrying their babies, either pre-horse or with horses, but this is what the mother used to carry her infant, correct?
Correct.
So that's a nice reminder to me. The second thing is the artistic beauty of it. Clearly they didn't need to do that. Is that common among Native American artifacts?
Yes, and especially those that were used for their children.
Kirby.
The deer hooves that you see on this on the fringe aren't only for ornamentation. They're also for the sound they make when they click together. That would help entertain the baby, keep them occupied as they played with them. And one of the things you do miss in a museum exhibit is the sound that was associated with these artifacts.
In one of the exhibition room, we've run into four visitors. Your name?
Garrison Vroman.
Why are you here?
Research.
What does that mean?
Family history.
What have you learned that you didn't know beforehand by being here?
There's a brand in this museum that dates back to my family, and it's our brand, and it goes back into history.
Why does that matter to you?
Because I want to know where I came from. I want to know my heritage.
In addition to your family history, do you learn anything else by being here?
I learned to be a good person here. I grew up on the reservation, and it's very racist there towards the Indians. The white man is very racist to them. But I don't understand why. Why are we racist to them? We are the ones that put them in this situation. We enabled everything.
But you wouldn't have to come here to reach that conclusion. So looking at these artifacts, which are Native American artifacts, how does that inform you as a citizen or as a person?
It makes me understand and look at it and look at the details of everything. Indians did things for a reason. They left a story behind. Why did they do that is what I'm trying to find.
Jennifer, tell us about this.
This is a Gros Ventre, white clay Gros Ventre teepee liner. It's muslin. It is decorated with pictographs just showing exploits, warrior exploits of various different ventures. You see colorful horses, Indian men with arrows and guns and fighting.
Now, is this traditional as to how Native peoples carried on their legends and stories?
Yes. For thousands of years, Native peoples had used pictographic images to describe their exploits. Of course, earlier on, it was rock, hide, and then when they acquired newer materials such as this muslin, they quickly incorporated that into that tradition.
Kirby?
The buffalo were gone, so in part, they had no choice. The other thing about using muslin or canvas, it would be much easier and also much lighter weight in terms of, especially if you're hauling all of your goods on a travelway behind your horse.
And as we are in the museum and there are visitors here, you may well hear voices. Kirby, it looks like I'm looking at a metal sculpture of a bison. What is this?
This is the remains of the weather vane, which at one point topped the kitchen at Fort Benton, which was established by the American Fur Company in 1846 on the Missouri River at the present-day town of Fort Benton. The weather vane probably dates to about 1885 or so.
Tell us about Fort Benton, what it represented, other than just a fort.
It was not a military fort, it was a trading fort. So it represents the whole story of the economy of the area, how it would changed when Europeans came into the area, you know, what that did to the native economy, how the natives contributed to the European economy, the importance of buffalo originally, and beaver, other animals, where they would bring in the pelts to trade.
How did people get to and from Fort Benton?
Non-Indians came up the Missouri River, primarily from St. Louis, was the big point of embarkation. Native Americans came, of course, across land. The Blackfeet, I think, were the predominant people in that area, but certainly other tribes would have come in as well.
And how do you go up the Missouri River?
Well, on a steamboat, if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, you have to pull your way like Lewis and Clark did.
This is Home Ground, and you're listening to Brian Kahn. We're at the Montana Historical Society talking about why our history matters. Now we're looking at something I don't understand. It has a round, thick stone base, metal pole, and then a wood disc thick, it looks like it might weigh 10 pounds, on the pole, maybe 2 feet above the stone metal base. What are we looking at?
These are burr stones from the first flour mill in Montana. They were brought to St. Mary's Mission in the Bitterroot in 1845 by Father Ravalli, who was an Italian missionary who came to work with the Salish.
And Ravalli County, Ravalli is named for him.
Absolutely, yes.
So in effect, we're looking at the first mechanized grain mill in Montana. Where did the wheat come from?
Well, that also was Father Ravalli's doing. He started the first agriculture program at the mission there, and it certainly would have been one of the first in the state, or what would become the state.
Today we're used to vast milling operations. What was the production capacity of this?
Well, in 1879, Father Ravalli reminisced, they were able to grind about 4 bushels a day. He called it a coarse flour, but exquisite for them in that day.
Now, we're looking at a sign above a painting, and the sign says, "Night attack in the Indian country, circa 1868. What was going on in Indian country in terms of battles and war at that time?
During that time, the Bozeman Trail brought settlers right across Indian territory, contrary to negotiated treaties. Red Cloud and his warriors began skirmishes against settlers through there. So there were people killed, and there were fought battles between the Sioux and soldiers.
Roughly what period are we talking about?
Basically, it would be from the time of European contact up until Wounded Knee in the 1880s.
Okay, so this drawing we're looking at was written toward the end, 1868. Now tell us about the drawing.
Well, it's a very small, simple pencil sketch. You see a couple lying in bed, and they are being attacked by mosquitoes.
So it's a joke, night attack, parenthesis, by mosquitoes.
Right.
Here is a large, roughly made wooden trunk. Wood boards, wood bands, metal fittings. It's about 3.5 feet long, 2.5 feet high, 2.5 feet deep. It looks like the kind of trunk that people would put their belongings in. It has some writing on it. What are we looking at, Kirby?
Well, this is an immigrant's trunk, someone named Bremen, who came from Germany to, as it's marked, Helena City, Montana Territory, U.S., America. America spelled with a K. This is the sort of thing that they very likely only brought one or two trunks. It would have contained all their earthly possessions, everything that was the most important to them that they wanted to bring from the old country with them. It is, as you pointed out, roughly made, but it's also very sturdy, and it clearly shows a lot of sign of wear and tear, probably had a rough voyage over on a ship.
So they would have come on a ship, and depending on the date, and this says 1860 to 1880, they would have come by wagon or potentially by railroad?
Not by 1880. They wouldn't have come the full way to Montana by railroad until 1882 when the Northern Pacific Line was completed. They might have come partway by railroad and then the rest of the way by stage. The other way is that they would have come up the Missouri River by steamboat to Fort Benton and then overland either freight wagon or stagecoach.
It's just striking to me because in our day of modern-day possessions, potentially a glut of possessions, this obviously contained a lot of what that whole family had and what they brought to Montana with their hopes.
Yes, it did. And it also, to me, raises the question of why did you save this rough wooden box? I mean, from our perspective, it's amazingly cool that somebody saved something that's so illustrative of that immigration experience. But at the time, it was pretty rough wooden box. You know, why did they save it? Was it sentimental value? Did they use it to store things out in the barn?
Now, mining is obviously an intrinsic and important part of this 150-year history. We're looking at a painting that says, title of which, My Cabin in Montana, 1866. So this is early in mining. Fair enough?
Very early. Still during the placer mining era. Peter Toft, who did this painting, was a Danish immigrant, came to Montana to mine, hurt himself, and so he actually kind of, he'd always been an artist, but he spent more time painting than he did mining once he was here. I like this piece because it illustrates the way that history hasn't changed. I mean, what we have in common with our ancestors. He's sitting in front of a nice fire in his fireplace. He's in a comfortable chair. He's reading a good book, and it's very easy for me to envision myself in this painting.
And he's sitting in a log cabin, one story high, prominent fireplace, but very small dimensions. I'm going to say it looks like it might be 10-foot-wide log cabin. Comfortable, amply furnished, and rustic. Fair enough?
That's fair. I think the most important thing is probably that it's warm and dry, which would be most welcome. The other thing that's unusual, if you look over the mantle of the fireplace, you can see that there's a painting. I'm sure that's one of Toff's. It looks like an Indian village, and that would not have been common in every miner's cabin.
I think your comment about the painting is very striking. This is a basic, down-to-earth log cabin. He's reading a book, and he has a painting. And those are reflections of, I would say, Western definitions of culture. Now, if you just step across the hall here, there is a description of the founding of this historical society, and I want to read a quote of the society's mandate, which was clearly written by founders of modern-day Montana, to provide for, quote, the use, learning, culture, and enjoyment of the citizens of the state, and for the acquisition, preservation, and protection of historical records, art, archival, and museum objects, historical places, and monuments. Now, someone might say, coming from just looking at a log cabin of a miner and a primitive grain grinder, that this is a pretty grandiose, ambitious vision. What do you say?
I would agree. I think that's true. I think... You know, they had foresight, they believed what they were doing was important, and they wanted to make sure that they preserved that for the future. I think another thing to remember is that whereas today we take very seriously our mission to serve the public, originally the society basically was formed as a private gentleman's club. The founding directors were all named in legislation. They were all, you know, wealthy white men. So they had a particular vision of whose history they were going to save.
Jennifer, let me ask you, because Kirby just interjected something very interesting that hadn't occurred to me, that these were white men at that time calling the shots. But I want to go back to another part of it. This is a bare-bones, boomtown, rock'em-sock'em economy. Miners coming in, building bars, houses of prostitution, schools, churches. But if you see the photographs, it's pretty hard scrabble. This is a lofty vision. What do you take from that as a historian?
As a historian, I think it's amazing that they would have such foresight. And then also how this society has fulfilled and grown into that vision and transformed into something they could not even imagine.
Considering the contrast between the initially hard-scrabble economy and the lofty vision that we just talked about, potentially of, as Kirby said, white men of means, we're looking at an odd bathrobe. What is it?
It is a standard electrothermal coat from 1908, and it is an electrified coat to keep you warm in the winter. And in 1908, electricity was here in Helena. It belonged to Tommy Cruz.
So this, to me, reflects new technology, electricity, which we tend to think supplying industry and transportation and lights, applied by some innovative person to provide himself with a warm winter coat. Fair?
That's correct. And Tommy Cruz was a wealthy man in 1908, but he didn't start that way. He came from Cavan, Ireland, from the parish of Drumlummon, and started out as a miner with nothing in his pocket here in 1867.
There are some interesting other aspects, aren't there, to Thomas Cruz's life?
Yes, he became so wealthy, he contributed to the building of the cathedral. He was the largest contributor to the cathedral. And interestingly enough, he was the first funeral to have been performed there.
Here's another aspect of mining. We're looking at a broken piece of wood, about a foot long, not quite rectangular, maybe 8 to 6 inches wide, tapered with some, looks like chalk writing on it. What is that?
It is the farewell message from Emil Anderson from the worst coal mine disaster to occur in Montana history, which happened in February of 1943. An open flame touched off an explosion in the number 3 Smith Mine in Bear Creek near Red Lodge. Explosion erupted deep underground, and 77 miners went to work that day, and only 3 survived.
Kirby, with this wood sign, or farewell, and other artifacts, how do you preserve them?
Well, it depends basically on what type of artifact. This one is an example of something that's very difficult to preserve because it is written with chalk. The chalk is laying there as well. And it's what we call a friable media, which means it's not a permanent sort of thing. And you can see that the chalk is basically being lifted off over time, and that's why there's glass laying across the top of it, is to keep, because the circulation of the air actually removes the chalk.
So do you have a group of specialists that work on these kind of things? Because there are fabrics here, there are beadwork, there's leather, there's all sorts of things that need preservation.
Unfortunately, we don't have anyone on staff because we don't have the funding, but we use professional conservators on a contract basis, and they do specialize in different types of materials.
This is Home Ground, and you're listening to Brian Kahn. We're at the Montana Historical Society talking about why our history matters. Help me understand this. I'm looking at a large, colorful banner about 5 feet by 5 feet with its blue and gold fringe. It says, First Montana Infantry USA.
These are the regimental colors that were carried to the Philippines and back by the 1st Montana Volunteers in 1898 following the Spanish-American War. In 1905, the legislature created the 1st Montana flag based on this design because of the importance they felt this flag had to the people of Montana.
And the image in it is mountains, rivers, mining, trees, a pick and shovel, a plow for agriculture, and it says Oro y Plata, which is still our state.
It is, silver and gold. The mountains are western Montana mountains. The water is the Great Falls of the Missouri. This is another interesting example. The silk was very old, very brittle. It's been conserved by a professional textile conservator. And in this photograph that I'm showing you, you can see the incredible difference. The flag was basically in shatters. Pieces were missing about 10 years ago today. It's professionally mounted on archival quality material in its own special case for long-term preservation.
It looks perfect. And we're standing in front of what I gather is a mechanized device, a drill that planted seeds, was drawn by horses, large metal wheels, 6 or 7 feet across. And in front of it are stark black and white photographs from the teens through the Depression of dust bowls, drought, hard times, hungry people. What does this say to you, Jennifer?
It talks about the landscape of Montana. Between 1917 and 1919, drought ravaged eastern Montana, and many of the homesteads folded. And then again, between 1931 and 1937, another drought occurred. Grasshopper infestations destroyed crops, and dust bowl drifting soil did more. It was just a terrible time, and the land just could not take the agriculture.
The final photograph on the right is two men eating at a small table being served coffee by the woman in the family. Very simple furniture, and there's a sign behind them. A man may be down, but he's never out. Seems symbolic of parts of our story.
That's true. It speaks to the hardship of the people that settled this land and the spirit that kept them going.
And now we're looking at three sets of documents, two handwritten, one printed. The first two, Constitutions of 1884 and 1889 for the state of Montana, and the last one, the Constitution of 1972. So my first question to you, Kirby, is, are these just exceptional documents, or does the Historical Society have an extensive collection of such documents?
The Historical Society has a huge collection, the largest collection of documents related to Montana history in the world, but these are also three extremely important documents. They get to the foundation of life in America. I mean, what's more important than a constitution? We have the 1889 Constitution, which is what granted us statehood, and then we have 1972 Constitution, which is certainly an exemplary document of its sort. I mean, I think it you know, what touches more of our lives on a daily basis than our founding constitution.
For example?
Well, I think to me personally, one of the most important is the Indian Education for All. I think, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about the society was founded by important white men, and I think it's very important that we tell everyone's story, Indians, women, poor people, rich people. I mean, that's part of what makes the story so great is the diversity, and I think it's very important that we pay attention to that.
And that is reflected as a mandate in the Montana Constitution, correct?
Correct, in the mandate for that everyone receive education on the essential understandings of Montana Indians.
Jennifer, the same question, except you're not only a historian, but you're a woman. We discussed the beginnings of the Historical Society by white men who had a vision. What does this Constitution mean to you?
I would have to agree with Kirby that this Constitution was an incredibly important for Montana and continues to work well for us today. There were women involved in the forming of the Constitution, women delegates. The Constitution advocated environmental protections, open meeting regulations, and personal rights protection.
Would it be going too far to suggest that this document exemplifies and articulates the cumulative wisdom derived from that tumultuous history that we have just touched on here?
I think that actually sums it up very clearly, and we're honored to be able to care for the original Constitution here and to continue that legacy, preserve that story for future generations.
Kirby, a final word?
Well, I think many of the artifacts we've been looking at this morning are things that tell a very personal story that are particular to that person or that family. The Constitution is something that is also important because it's something that we as Montanans hold together. We own it and we share it.
We are now on the third floor of the museum, the Historical Society building, in an office. Young lady, you are?
I'm Glenda Bradshaw. I'm the photo editor for the publications program.
What is the publications program?
We publish Montana, the Magazine of Western History, which is a quarterly that covers Montana and history of the West. We also have the Montana Historical Society Press. We have over 50 books in print, and we have more than 20 e-books now.
How long have you worked here?
Over 25 years.
Why would you say, for the people of Montana, that knowing their history matters?
It just seems like people need to know where they came from. That seems to be important to people, and people who don't have it seem to always be seeking it.
Bruce Wittenberg is the director of the Montana Historical Society. Bruce, first, I want to thank you so much for making your fine staff available to us.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We love sharing the work of the Montana Historical Society.
Someone might say that everything that we've just talked about in this program is ancient history and has nothing to do with the world we live in today.
It's been said that before you know where you're going, you have to know where you've been. And in all of these stories and all of these artifacts and all this archival material that are available to us here in Montana, there are stories and there are lessons. There are lessons of success and failure and the hard work and the inspiration and the violence that occurred in Montana's history, lessons that can teach us a lot about how to plan our future and how to prepare for future generations for what's to come. I believe in that. Before you know where you're going, you have to know where you've been, and that's really what the mission of the Montana Historical Society is all about.
Bruce Wittenberg and your excellent staff, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.